listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Lost in all the stories of surges and elections in Iraq is the fact that over 2 million Iraqis who have fled their country since the U.S. invasion are still living elsewhere. Deborah Amos tells the story of these refugees and of their challenging lives in exile and what this all means for the future of the region in her new book, Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East. It's published by Public Affairs. Ms. Amos, I'm sure you know, has reported on Iraq for NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Weekend Edition, and she's also worked in television for PBS and ABC News, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show today. Hi.
Thanks very much for having me back. Hi.
Isn't this story a sidebar to the more general reporting that you've been doing from Iraq?
Actually, it wasn't. After 2005, when it was almost impossible to go out on the street, to go to a restaurant, to get in a taxi, to do all the things that you do as a reporter, I left Iraq. And I realized about a year later that I could continue talking to Iraqis if I went to the places of exile, which turned out to be Damascus, Amman, Beirut, Cairo, and Turkey. And so I started those rounds, and my foreign editor allowed me to do it. It took a long time to do it. It's not like there's a phone book, you know, the refugee handbook. Here are the numbers. It takes a while to ferret people out, to find people who trust you. And I stuck with it, and NPR let me stick with it for about 2 years, and I was able to collect these stories.
And realized somewhere down the line that it also would make an interesting book.
Yeah, in the early days, I wanted to call it First Leave Everything You Love, which is from a Dante poem. And he wrote about the pain of political exile, which is what is the truth for them. And over time, I realized that there was such a sectarian element to what was happening that we all agreed that we would change the title to The Eclipse of the Sunnis, which for Americans may seem like a play on words, but in the Middle East, it's like a slap in the face.
Mm. It's interesting that Dante was kind of an internal exile, because even though he had to move to another city-state, he stayed in Italy. How many of the refugees are internal exiles in Iraq?
2.35, according to the...
Internal or...
Internal.
And then we have all these others who are outside.
1.9 outside with no large returns, and 3.25 million. And that is a U.S. government number.
And those 2-plus million, where are they living?
A lot of them live in camps, displaced person camps. A lot of them have obviously not gone back. So it's not a great life. But here's what part of the problem is. Many people were moved out of their houses by militias. So you have about 1 million homes that are in dispute. So if you want to move out of that camp and come back to your home, somebody else is in it. And almost more likely, somebody from another sectarian group. So you need the army or the police to get them out. And the government has had a program, but it hasn't addressed the huge numbers that we're talking about.
Are most of the people who left Sunnis?
60% of the refugees who are on record at the UN are Sunnis.
So that means 40% are not. Some of them are Christians, but there weren't that many Christians in the country.
About 15% are Christians, and considering that they were less than 3% of the population before the war, that's a very large number of the Christian community who have left.
And then Shiites who had to move out of Sunni areas?
That's who they are, some secular Shiites, some in mixed marriages. It became almost impossible to be in a mixed marriage in Baghdad. I read about a lot of people who were targeted because they were in a mixed marriage, and one sectarian group said, sorry, out.
Well, should we be all that surprised by what's happened? Because the Sunni minority oppressed the Shiite majority for most of Iraq's history, and at least we're not seeing the kind of bloodbath that we saw in Rwanda.
No, but this is not Rwanda. This is a very different, more literate culture, much more educated culture. And, of course, what the Sunnis would argue is that we didn't oppress the Shiites. Saddam did.
Well, weren't they allied in many cases? After all, the Sunnis were the ones who benefited from what Saddam was doing.
They did, but I would also argue that there were more Shiites in the Ba'ath Party than there were Sunnis, and simply because there are more Shiites in the country. I think everybody suffered under Saddam. That would be a fair thing to say. The Sunnis benefited more, as they do throughout the region. Most parts of the Middle East are run by Sunnis. They are the majority in the Middle East.
And except for one of the Iraq's neighbors, Iran. So I would have thought that when the Sunnis left, they would be welcomed in the Sunni countries.
Well, they weren't because the neighbors are poor. And the neighbors actually had to take most of the care of these people. These are economies that are subsidized in Jordan, in Syria. So if a refugee arrives, legal or illegal, and drinks the water, buys the gasoline, eats the bread, goes to the hospital, sends their children to the schools, they're actually taking money from the Jordanian government, from the Syrian government. Syria said it was about $2 billion that they were paying to support these people, aside from what the UN was putting in.
But many of these people are very well-educated, middle-class teachers, television producers, writers, at least the people you talk to, bureaucrats. I would have assumed that they're the kinds of people that the neighboring countries would welcome because they would enrich the culture.
In the beginning, that was true, when the numbers were low. In fact, there is a university outside of Damascus that was opened by Iraqi professors and from five different universities from Baghdad. So what you had was like the head of the medical school at Baghdad University, who was run out of town by radicals, and he shows up in Damascus. They all find each other. They open a university. It's the first time that Syria has had an English language university with actually a low, it's private, a low fee. Mm-hmm. So kids are coming back from the Gulf, they could get a $7,000 education and giving up the $30,000 one that they were getting in the Gulf. So yes, a lot of, in Jordan, a lot of doctors got jobs in the hospitals, but eventually it just became too much. It became overwhelming.
So most of them are now denied the opportunity to work? Do they live in the gray economy?
Most of them live in the gray economy. That's where they've been forced to go. And a lot of times it's their kids who are working. It's easier for a 14-year-old to get a job in a factory than it is for a 45-year-old. It's easier for a 6-year-old to get a job putting that little bit of charcoal into the nargila at the local restaurant, which keeps that kid out of school.
But since many of these people had resources back home, I would think that they have some. They can survive because they took some money with them. They took other things with them that would help them get along.
But think about this, Leonard. If somehow you had to go to Canada and you didn't know how long you were going to stay, and you got to
the end of the Vietnam War,
yes, and you took out your savings, there is a moment. Mm-hmm. When you don't last. And the same thing for them. And there's a moment with many of them that they're down to gas fumes.
Well, you mentioned that they've moved to some of the neighbors, but they've also been going to Turkey. I guess that's because of the connection there. That's a border.
They could get
and Egypt. Why not countries like the Emirates or Saudi Arabia, where there are booming economies? I would think they'd be more welcoming.
Saudi Arabia put up the wall and said, no, thank you, and made it very clear that they did not want any refugees. And there aren't any there because, remember, in 91, the Saudis had quite a few refugees, and those only just left maybe, I don't know, 9-10 years ago. America took 13,000 by 1992. And they aren't welcome in Egypt. As I said before, these are poor economies. And a wave of people is really not welcome. Syria's unemployment is up at 25%. The last thing they need is a million people who are looking for jobs. This doesn't go down well. What's been surprising to me is that every place the Iraqis have gone, there hasn't been a lot of demonstrations against them. I mean, what I see is
because people recognize their plight.
Yes, and actually they have a lot of sympathy for what happened. And so they're not terribly mean. They may move out of a neighborhood when they don't hear their accent anymore. It's all Iraqis, and Iraqis open up restaurants, and you know they have a very vibrant culture in these places.
Although we were hearing earlier, I think about a year ago, about attacks on some of the Jordanian camps by Jordanian police, and all of that stuff is no longer happening.
There are no camps. And those camps may have been people who were at the border waiting to go back.
They were not official camps.
Yeah. You can live wherever you want in these places because no Arab government has recognized the 1951 UN Convention on Refugees. And they didn't because when the Palestinian refugees came in 1948 and everybody said, oh, someday they'll go back, these governments know, oh, no, they won't. And they didn't want to have to deal with another Palestinian refugee crisis. And so they never recognized the UN Convention. So what they see these people as is guests. They have about as many rights as a tourist. That's why they can't work.
My guest is Deborah Amos, Clips of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East is her new book from Public Affairs. Well, that because they don't, they haven't signed that treaty, does that mean that they have a different relationship with the UN than countries that have signed it?
Certainly. You get some protection if you sign up for with UNHCR. You have a letter in your pocket. But there were occasions early on when Jordan was hit with the wave that they were actually arresting people who were coming down to UNHCR to sign up. That was a dangerous place to be. And early on in this process, when I was interviewing people, the UN wouldn't let me out on that line because they said, if you interview somebody on that line, it will bring too much attention to them and they can be dragged off by the Mohabarat and put on a plane and sent back to Baghdad. It's calmed down quite a bit now. In fact, Jordan has lowered the amount of money you need to put in a bank account from $50,000 to $25,000 to be able to live there for a year. So the region is becoming more accepting of how long this is going to go on.
Now, what would happen if they were put on a plane and sent back to Baghdad?
Some of them died because of that.
I mean, they were killed?
They were killed. They had death threats against them. And that's why they left in the first place. It certainly happened in Lebanon. Lebanon's policy was, if we catch you and you're illegal, we will put you in jail. And your two choices are stay in jail forever or get on the plane to Baghdad, which was no choice at all.
They were chased out. Is this all a matter of ethnic cleansing?
It was certainly sectarian cleansing, which happened all the way up to 2007. It was raging during the surge, and certainly during the early days of the surge. More people left in 2007 than 2006.
Well, didn't the surge change things, and hasn't a certain amount of political stability changed things?
I argue that the surge was a tactical success but a strategic failure. The idea of the surge was to lower the violence in Baghdad so that the political elite could come to some sort of power-sharing political reconciliation between Sunni Shias and Kurds. That hasn't happened. And that's why I say that the surge was a strategic failure. We are still dealing with very raw and open sectarian divides in Iraq.
Well, we've been talking about sectarian divides, but a listener from the East Village, Frank, wants to know if any of the families or individuals moved out of Iraq because they were gay.
Yes, that has also
happened.
Had there
been more tolerance under Saddam Hussein, Mr. Macho?
Tolerance is probably hard to say. It was a more secular society. Now, in some neighborhoods where, you know, some religious radicals hold sway, there has been attacks on gay Iraqis, and many of them are in Lebanon waiting to be resettled. This has become a whole category, as well in Turkey. I talk to people who are dealing with that community in Turkey.
And, of course, women have been affected very powerfully. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that and more. My guest is Deborah Amos of NPR. Her book, Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East. It's published by Public Affairs. Stay with us. We're back with Deborah Amos of NPR. She's written a book called Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East, published by Public Affairs. And I heard a report from you recently about what women have to go through. And many of the people you write about who've ended up in the cities outside of Iraq are women. Often they're the sole caretakers of their family. You interviewed many of them, and a lot of these stories are really sad.
Well, the saddest of all are the mothers who have to turn to survival sex to support their families. And there's plenty of them in Damascus, about a quarter of the refugees who are signed up with UNHCR. And I have to say that those who are signed up with UNHCR are only about 10% of the population, but they do become prostitutes to take care of their kids.
Well, there must have been prostitution in Iraq.
There was. And almost everybody tells me that during sanction time, this is when this phenomenon really began. And you would see it was rampant at the universities. And so it's not a big surprise that people would take it up again.
And you say that the sanctions had some of the most powerful effects on women. Why?
Because it was so difficult to keep your family together. Middle class families just slid into poverty. I remember a friend of mine who is now a doctor in the States, and he's talked about his dad, who was a car salesman. He lost everything, and they ate tomatoes and onions every day. And he used to say, the first George Bush starved us, the second one drove us out. He's a Sunni. He had to leave the country. And this is, I think, that the sanction time, in the worst of it certainly, was a character killer. These were moments when families made horrible decisions to survive. And if you see your dad and your mom doing these things, and then you grow up and you think they're fine, then who knows what you'll do when you're in the same situation.
The prostitution you describe in these nightclubs seems kind of odd to us, because it is both circumspect and it's still prostitution.
Indeed, and there's a odd conservative element to it. For example, father and mother will take their daughter to a nightclub. They know that she's going to be sold, but they want to meet the guy. So that's part of a old conservative value, but we're still talking about prostitution.
And the women dance with each other.
Well, here's the thing, because I danced with them as well, because you go to a club like this and everybody just assumes that you're there to be for sale, and it was safer up on the dance floor than it was back in the back where it was dark. And the reason that women dance with women and men dance with men is because anything else is a business proposition. And there is a great deal of romance, pretend romance, and teasing in the way that all of this sex is carried out. Nobody pairs up till 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, you're showing off your wares.
You are showing off your wares. There is a lot of flirting that goes on, a lot of price negotiation that goes on. And when you leave the club, you get in for free if you're a woman. When you leave the club, you tip the guy at the door if you leave with a man, because now he knows that you have made a deal.
Are women wearing scarves and veils?
Well, some do, but it's very rare. No, these are incredibly revealing. Iraqi women tend to be big, and a value is to be meaty. So we're talking, lots
that
of cleavage.
That Iraqi word, zaftik.
Oh, very zaftik. So we're talking lots of cleavage, lots of leg, lots of gleaming hair. The only reason that a woman might wear a veil, a niqab, which is one of those veils that covers everything except for her eyes, is the fear that one of her male relatives might be in the club. And there are people who worry about that. And so if a male relative sees you back in Baghdad, that is an honor crime offense. Could be duty bound to kill you if you ever came back home.
I feel silly asking this question, but when you were dancing at the club, you were obviously not an Iraqi woman. Did anybody make a proposition?
Sure, yeah. I came in with a woman who, it turned out, was a madam, and she came to me late in the night. She said, we've had an offer on you. I said, thank you very much. I think I'll pass.
You didn't say how much first?
No, I didn't want to know. But, there was a part of me that thought, oh, my God, if they knew I was an American, my price would probably go up. I mean, there is some anti-Americanism that could be expressed in buying an American woman.
Hasn't there been an effort to bring these refugees back to Iraq?
Well, by whom?
There have been some incentives, haven't there? There have been offers of better jobs, places to live.
The first time that Prime Minister Maliki did it was in 2007, and he offered $800. It was a complete disaster. It took more than 48 hours for the buses to get to Baghdad. It was
these bus caravans.
Oh, it was chaotic, and some of those people were killed or kidnapped as they came out of the hotel, because they put it on the media, so a lot of people knew they had $800 in their back pocket. It was such a public relations stunt. They didn't do it again for another year. And again, they offered money. A lot of people didn't get it. And most people said, no, thank you. So they've actually stopped doing those caravans because it looks bad.
Well, what would happen if somebody returned to the home that they'd had to abandon?
They wouldn't make it back out of the neighborhood. And that has happened. Mm-hmm. You can't go by yourself if you are a Sunni or a Shia to your old neighborhood that has changed and get your house back. It just doesn't happen.
So somebody else now owns your house.
They don't own it, but they are squatting in it. I'll tell you a story about a neighborhood in a place called Haria. And there was an effort to bring some Sunnis back. And this family arrives. The army gets his house back for him. But he arrives in his house, and everything is gone. Down to the floor is now dirt. And there is a giant picture of a Shiite holy person that was tacked up on his living room wall. Now, he's terrified to take that thing down because this neighborhood is predominantly Shiite. He's a Sunni. So now he has to put all of his appliances back in the house, and he's got a great big picture of a Shia holy person in his living room.
Why do you think Americans know so little about this whole situation?
Well,
has it been government policy, do you think, or reporters not been interested in this?
I think reporters weren't because it was hard. I think that you needed a sympathetic boss to allow you to do it. I did it for 2 years. That was pretty amazing. It was easy. A lot of people, and if you go look at Google, you'll see a lot of people wrote about refugees. And the story is always 2 million outside, 2 million inside, oh, whoa. But no real face to who that was, because that took some work. And you know what's happening with journalism. Budgets are shrinking. Foreign corresponding is shrinking. You have enough money to keep your person in Baghdad and maybe one in Afghanistan, but do you have enough money to let one of us run around and interview refugees? And I was just lucky enough to work for a company that allowed me to do it.
Well, as I understand it, NPR right now is the only major news source that is maintaining a regular Baghdad office. Is that true?
And well, the Washington Post is there, and the New York Times is there. And there are some freelancers who, have worked for people. Christian Science Monitor's got somebody there. But it's certainly not like it was. Everybody could fit on one floor of the hotel that used to be filled when I first came in 2003, and those people are now all in Afghanistan.
Deborah Amos is here with us in New York. She's written a book called Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What I remember when the refugee story first came out was that the Bush administration really wanted to bury it because there was a lot of pressure to take some of these people into the United States.
That is absolutely true. The president never said anything about the refugees, and he particularly never said anything about those Iraqis who put their lives at risk for translating for American troops. And what we have now is about 33,000 Iraqis who have come to the United States. They now are actually the biggest refugee population of all, and they are having a terrible time here. The refugee system in America was designed for Vietnamese refugees. It's a broken system because states have been taking money out of it, because who is going to complain? You are expected to be self-sufficient within 2 to 3 months after arrival, and this is a traumatized population, many female-headed households.
Michigan is a place where many Muslims have gone in the past. This is not the place you want to go right now if you're looking for a job.
No, if you're lucky, and believe me, they know nothing about how the system works here. You get to Massachusetts, which signs you up for health care almost immediately. And, you know, there are plenty of people who have their heart attack as soon as they got off the plane when they get here because they feel they can finally have it here. They're safe. They come without that much screening. You can't tell what someone with PTSD looks like. But people come here very, very compromised and troubled.
You're saying there's a lot of PTSD just because these people have lived through these horrific situations.
Well, the figures for many of these refugees are something like 70% have seen a relative killed in front of their eyes. Rape, torture, extortion, you name it, and they have been through it.
Have things changed at all now that the Obama administration is in Washington?
Obama was the first candidate to speak of it at all, put it on his website, spoke about it when he announced the accelerated withdrawal. I mean, what he said is that solving the refugee crisis is key in how this withdrawal will work.
Because eventually we're going to see these refugees return, or some of them return. I can't imagine there being a permanent refugee situation. The Iraqi government is, whatever government it is that will be in place, is going to have to work this thing out, isn't it?
I think they are going to have to work this thing out. And who knows when they'll go back. They voted 42,000 Iraqi exiles voted in Syria in this election, which tells you that there are people who are still invested in their country. Something like 35,000 voted in Jordan. So it gives you the impression that these people do want to go home. The question that I have, and we don't know until the results of these elections are known, is this what they want? Is this political reconciliation?
Well, if Ayad Alawi, the most secular candidate in the March 7th parliamentary elections, comes out the eventual winner, do you think that some of these refugees will feel safe enough to return?
It's hard to imagine him becoming the winner, if you mean Iyad Alawi becoming the prime minister. I think that there's a little confusion about what we're talking about in the way that these elections have been portrayed in the press. He's done well, and so has Maliki, but neither one of them has enough seats in parliament to form a government. Now you get what I call three-dimensional chess and vicious musical chairs. That's going to go on for the next couple of months in coalition building. And Maliki may get the first shot at forming a government. And he has many more choices than Alawi does to make a ruling coalition. So he can't ignore Alawi. But here's a very interesting event that happened in this election. Alawi's support comes from Baghdad and everything north, Sunni territory. Maliki is Baghdad and everything south, Shia territory. So you still have a country that is, even in when they go into the polls, is divided.
And then their Sadr has had a resurgence, hasn't he?
The radical cleric Muqtada Sadr has had a resurgence. They did very well in the elections. Some people say it's because they were more clever than anyone else. This is a very complicated election system. You almost need a telephone book worth of names, 6,000 candidates in an open list to figure out who you're going to vote for. They were strategic in the way that they played that game. One candidate, not three or four, as some of the other parties did. They did do well. They are very anti-American. I can't imagine them in any alliance with Iyad Alawi, much more likely to be with Maliki. They don't like him very much either, because he tried to put them down in Basra a couple of years ago. But still, I think there's going to be surprises in who runs Iraq.
The United States has taken in 33,000 of these refugees. The country that seems to be most generous is Sweden, 100,000 refugees.
100,000 refugees.
Why Sweden?
Because Sweden has a history of opening its doors. I think Iraqis knew that. There was an enormous amount of people who were getting themselves smuggled out of Jordan and Damascus back in 2007, 2008. And while Sweden is sending some of them home, it's really a remarkable number of people if you consider that they had nothing to do with this conflict. And that's quite a large population.
Earlier, Sweden allowed people in from the former Yugoslavia when it was disintegrating. So I guess it has a tradition along those lines. They must find some ways to integrate these refugees into the Swedish system.
Well, when American resettlement cases look at what Sweden gives them, you know, there's trade-offs everywhere. In Sweden, you get a stipend, and you have to learn Swedish, and maybe you might get a job, but nobody talks to you. In America, you don't get a job, but Americans, we're friendly. So pick your place you want to be.
Have any of the Shiite refugees gone to Iran?
I look at the voting rolls, and you can't extrapolate backwards perfectly, but 23,000 people voted, Iraqis voted.
I would assume that Iran would be more welcoming than the other countries.
They are for Shiites, but Sunnis need not apply in the same way that Shiites were not welcome in Jordan.
And there's been a lot written about the role that Ahmed Chalabi played in all of this and his connection to the Iranian government.
Indeed, and he actually had a hand, I think, in the way that the voting went. As you remember, right before the election, he and a colleague were the head of a government body, a debathification body, that blackballed 500 candidates, came to a little bit more than 100. And that set the tone for the elections. Most of the candidates that were blackballed were Sunnis, were from nationalist parties. There was a couple of weeks of campaigning that the Baathists were coming back. It set a real sectarian tone. But I have to say that the last time I checked, he did very badly, that he lost to number 83 on the Sadrist list in the elections. I don't know if he has enough votes to even have a seat in parliament. So while we may know his name, Iraqis don't.
Your writing includes a lot about food in the Middle East. Is that what keeps you going back?
Well, I have to say that I do love the food in the Middle East, and I know where the best food is to be had.
And where is the best food to be had?
Aleppo, Syria, hands down, the finest food. But I was so interested in Damascus in a phenomenon that I observed, that Iraqis opened at dozens of restaurants. And I would think, okay, this is lamb and tomatoes and onions, and how different can it be from what the Syrians make? But they said, no, no, no. Our lamb is better. Our spices are better. The grass that they eat needs to be near Iraq. Our fish are better. And they were bringing spices up. As 2,000 refugees were coming up every day, the driver would have a packet of spices that he would bring from the Baghdad market and deliver to all these restaurants.
Because, is that smuggling?
Oh, yeah, I suppose. But the cooks would always say, you know what? Iraqis will know. If we if we don't bring these spices up, Iraqis will know. So it's a form of nationalism.
Yeah. The same as the Japanese saying that the Japanese will recognize rice that's not from Japan, when that is very unlikely. But does this mean that you know the best places to get Middle Eastern food in the States?
No, it doesn't, because I'm never here. Although I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the moment, and you cannot imagine my joy to find in the shop around the corner they have Aleppo pepper. I can actually buy Aleppo pepper in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Deborah Amos's latest book is this it latest or first?
Second.
Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much for having me.